All right, hey everyone, welcome to This Anthro Life. As always, this is Adam Gamwell.
And I'm Matt Arts.
And we are brought to you in collaboration with the American Anthropological Association, with our friends over at the Society for Applied Anthropology, Sapiens, an online publication journal that's bringing science, communication, and anthro to wider audiences, as well as we're working on with our new friends from EPIC, the Ethnographic Praxis and Industry Conference. So we brought to you all these four groups, and the idea is, you know, we, as anthropologists, as people working in podcasting, working in digital media, working in tech, working in design, trying to bring the conversations to wider audiences and to spread the good news and the good work of anthropology. And if you like the program, you've been joining us for a while, thanks, you know, glad to have you back. If you're new to the program, welcome. We have a new Patreon, which is a crowdfunding platform and campaign that we're running that you can check out on the show notes of the podcast. What this is a small way to help support the program if you like it. You know, you can give as little as $1 a month, and that makes a huge difference to us because we run this entirely by ourselves, self-funded. We love making it, and we cannot, you know, wait to keep putting out more episodes. And 2018 is promising to be an amazing and awesome year. So if you got a dollar, you want to help, you know, give us a cup of coffee, as it were, hop on over to our Patreon page, and you can toss us a buck or two.
And today we talked to Natalie Hansen. Natalie is an anthropologist who has worked in the tech sector for about 20 years now. She's worked at SAP, currently at ZS Associates. She is the famous founder of the Anthro Design Community, starting as a listserv that is now on Slack. And today we talked about how software is a product of culture and the state of enterprise UX today, which Natalie works in, how she goes about selling research in the enterprise space, how that research may not always be perfect or live up to your expectations or desires of how a research project should go, and in the end, how you need to really learn the language and needs of all stakeholders involved, be that the project sponsor, end users, whoever it may be, to really build trust and lead a successful project.
Yeah, so we really enjoyed this episode, and we're excited to share it with you. You know, as we build more to talking, we build more conversations in the anthro and design and business space. So hope you enjoy our conversation with Natalie Hansen. We can kind of begin saying, you know, thank you so much for joining us, Natalie, on this Anthro Life. And we kind of love, again, we're kind of digging into these themes that are circling around UX and software, technology, anthropology. And you've been in this space for a number of decades. And so part of the thing we like to do here is to kind of begin with sort of your origin story. You know, what got you from, you know, what's your superhero origin story, in essence? You know, what radioactive, you know, spider did you get bitten by that brought you from where you were to the UX in the technology world?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was just talking to a graduate student today about this, and I think it's got a beautiful bow on it when you can look at on it the rearview mirror, you know, 20 years mm-hmm. in the rearview mirror. But it certainly wasn't that way at first, and I know my parents despaired with the way that my career evolved that I would ever end up doing anything worthwhile, right? But so I think for me, the beginning was. Or the place that I often start is by saying that when I became interested in culture, as I studied religion and biblical literature at Smith, Smith College in Massachusetts. And I just became very interested at the time. There was a lot of strife in the Middle East. Of course, there still is. But I was interested in how is religion driving the relationship between people. And I wanted to use that as a way to understand some of the tensions in that part of the world. That led me into after a period of time in the working world, I went into a program called Whole Systems Design, which is at Antioch University in Seattle. That program doesn't exist anymore, but it was a really neat, non-traditional program. We studied design theory and systems theory together. Harold Nelson, who was the chair of the program at the time, is still writing and speaking on these topics. I really, really enjoyed that sort of macro thinking, I think. How do you think about a system at a macro level that way? I thought it was very eye-opening for me. What I came to realize later was that the idea of human agency or people actually affecting these black boxes and these line drawings and stuff, that whole idea about human agency is just not in systems theory. Hmm. And what I really came to love when I got exposed to anthropology later, I was working in academic computing at Mills College in Oakland. And what I came to love as I got exposed to anthropology was this idea about culture and the fact that there is so much about human and human complexity that actually makes these things happen, and that it is much more complex than a systems diagram could possibly explain. in particular at Mills, I was on the staff there, but I was taking classes and sort of working my way towards grad school. And I took some courses in visual anthropology, and I just really came to love the idea that we tell stories about culture in many ways, right? And for me, visual in particular, I had always been drawn to the arts. In fact, sort of thinking about the common thread through a lot of my work, even today, is as early as the fifth grade, I was talking about art as a product of culture. I found, was cleaning up my archives, and I found a term paper that I had written in the fifth grade using library archives. And it was about needlepoint in American culture and how needlepoint evolved when it came to the colonies.
Wow. Really?
And it was written with all primary source materials with the help of a librarian and an archivist. And so similarly at in my master's program, I was looking at weaving. I was studying weaving in Indonesia, and I had looked at Navajo rugs and sort of saying, how does the culture express itself through these creative forms? And so that's sort of been the thread. And I know it seems, okay, how do you end up in the software industry? But actually, there's some really great stories and quotes. I don't have the pithy ones here in front of me, but basically, you know, the software is a product of the culture in which it was developed, right? And so the better you understand and the healthier and more functional a work culture you have, the better the product you can produce. So after that master's degree, I was at Mills and I was taking all these courses in anthropology, and then I eventually got in to do my PhD in anthropology at Temple University. And I chose Temple in particular because it had this focus on the anthropology of visual communication. And I felt I was really excited about anthropology, but I didn't want to lose this piece about creativity and expression that I'd sort of realized was a common thread through the work I had done before. And so that was what drew me to the Temple program specifically. While I was there, I was working full time. I had a grad assistantship, not in anthropology, but in academic computing, because I came from academic computing at Mills. So I worked in academic computing and paid my way through my first couple years of the residency of grad school by working in academic computing. And then after I completed that residency requirement, it was like 2 years I had to be full time in the grad program. I ended up getting a job at SAP, and I spent almost 15 years there. And I learned a lot about how the software industry works and how business works. And that was where I built my first UX team in an era where the term UX was just becoming known. I was the researcher and I hired a designer, and we were the original UX team. And that team grew to almost 20 people by the time I left there in 2011, and work was important enough to the company. It wasn't on the product side of SAP, but it was on the internal operations side, that most of our capacity was allocated by the C-level executives. So we would have those conversations with the CIO and the chief process officer, and we would say, hey, these are the number of person hours we have available for the IT portfolio. Where should those hours be best spent? So that was pretty exciting to be at that point, and I really enjoyed that aspect of my time there. And we'll talk a little bit later about, you know, how do you sell. I think interacting with C-level executives that only have a few minutes to give you and who have very short attention spans and a million other things on your mind, you're forced to learn to be incredibly concise in terms of how you tell your story. You know, you get one slide if you're lucky. Yeah. And so that was a really good way for me to sort of hone my skills in terms of how I talk about what we do.
And kind of related to that time constraint and the sort of those political kind of dynamics, what was it like studying up in that space for your dissertation?
Oh, yeah. Incredibly challenging. And also very, very exciting because the software industry was undergoing huge shifts at that time. And so I think it was a real privilege to be in an industry, to be able to sort of trace those things as they were happening. So really what was happening in tech during that period was companies, it was right, you know, I was studying right during that dot-com crash. And the question was, how do we stop being so technology-centric and start thinking more about our customers? And like, what a brilliant time to be an anthropologist in that environment, right? Mm-hmm. Not only to see those shifts in the discourse happening in tech, but to actually witness that happening inside of a company, what kind of transformations are required to actually make that a reality, especially at the time. I mean, SAP was, it's 75 plus thousand people now. I remember what it was at that time, but 40, 50,000 people, something like that. And thinking about what do you need to do to mobilize a company like that to respond to what the market is demanding was really, really interesting to watch that unfold and get to be a part of it.
Without getting too maybe ahead of ourselves, have you experienced anything else like the dot-com bust that has helped ushered in greater appreciation? I mean, maybe like the sort of rise of design thinking in the media, but anything on the same level of the dot-com bust?
No, I do think the design thinking is probably the other big one. Then there are others that I would characterize as maybe less so, but still worth noting and depending on what industry you're in. So for me, agile in high tech has been huge, and lean if you're in more on the manufacturing kind of environment. And what those have in common, and I've written about that on my blog, is in agile, there's an expression, get out of the building, or goob. Right. And so the idea is if you're going to build good software, you need to goop. You have to get out of the building and talk to people, even if it means you're doing intercept interviews on the street or going to talk to friends and family. That's an essential part about how you build an agile is by talking and iterating with people. And similarly, lean, you know, the tenet of lean is, you know, you have to walk the shop floor. You cannot make things better if you don't really understand what's going on the shop floor. And a lot of times executives can't do that. But they recognize the need, and an ethnographer, someone who understands both the business and the people, can walk the shop floor on behalf of that executive and help elevate some of those people and process related issues that help companies become more effective with a human and market centric way of thinking. I do see Agile in particular as being a particular challenge, and I wouldn't characterize it as a crisis, but we'll talk about this a little bit more later, but as there's more and more research that's characterized as UX research or design research, figuring out how to do meaningful work in the context of Agile is incredibly challenging.
Yeah, absolutely. And, Adam and I were recently looking at an article on the sort of UXification of design research.
Yes, Simon Roberts, mm-hmm.
Fits right into this. It was a great space, and certainly developing that rich, deep, kind of thick understanding in that compressed time frame is hard, and to you sort of left feeling maybe not having the full amount of empathy you need, to use kind of the catchphrase at the moment, but you're left in a little bit of a bubble, but you need to move fast because it's industry, and it's definitely a challenge.
Yeah, I think we can certainly talk more. That's actually in my list of things to talk about with Simon's article, but he says he's a little bit wistful about times gone by, and I'm not sure that there was ever a time like that, except that he was at Intel at one point, I believe. And so I think when you're in R&D, it is a different beast, right? Mm-hmm. But when you're in consulting and you're driven to a certain extent by being profitable, I do think that the nature of the work that you have the freedom to do is different.
Mm-hmm. In your both at SAP and now ZS, have you had the opportunity to do much generative research?
Yeah, I have. But it's not something that happens, just immediately or spontaneously as you get to know someone. Just because you're an anthropologist or you're, an accomplished business professional doesn't necessarily open up those doors. But I have had those opportunities when I've established trust and rapport with a customer or a sponsor over a period of time. And oftentimes it's by doing less appealing work first. I wouldn't say less appealing, but maybe less exciting for me as an anthropologist, right? Oh, I need a web page design. Oh, I need a satisfaction survey executed, right? Might not be as exciting the work as you want to be doing, right? It's not a full-blown ethnography or something like that, but it's work that the customer needs and that you can do well. But when you do those things well and you are able to talk in an articulate way about what you do and what else you could do over time, I think it opens up the trust and the opportunity to do that kind of work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And would you mind maybe telling everybody, maybe we should step back a second and talk a little bit about kind of your current role, A little bit more about building the UX teams and kind of how you went about that, and sort of, you know, the state of UX at the enterprise level today, which you mostly work in.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So I was at SAP for almost 15 years, and in there, I was really in a variety of business roles. I wasn't a UX leader or a design leader. I think the climate has changed at SAP, and for a number of reasons, including Sam Yen's, you know, now as the chief design officer there. But when I was there, it was, you know, it was more of a skunkworks kind of thing. It was something that we did, and we built some excitement and momentum for it, but it was never a huge part of the company, even considering the number of the number of software developers that SAP has. And so about 6 years ago, I was approached by ZS. ZS is a professional services firm, which is largely focused in the life sciences. And historically, we've done a lot of work in sales and marketing. And those last 7 or 8 years of my career at ZS were in sales and marketing operations. So I had really been doing the work very much in line with the kind of things that ZS did. And what they were interested in for me was that I really understood how software got made. I had built UX from scratch. And I was interested in ZS. You know, I'd been at SAP a long time, and I was ready to do something new. And I loved the idea of building something. And in this case, was also reporting to the CTO, the chief technology officer. And I liked the idea of, you know, having a more senior role and having more authority to shape the direction of the team and of the organization by being a member of the leadership team in the engineering group. And so that was really what prompted, and it required a relocation. So that's been also new, learning to be a Midwesterner, which is in its own set of learnings after many years. I mean, even though I lived on the West Coast, I still consider myself an East Coaster by, you know, deeply ingrained culturally. Sure. I think you can never take, if you've been raised in New England, you can't really ever shed that. So anyways, it was a very interesting period. We had a lot of work to do to standardize. We had a lot of legacy code. We had to learn how to be much more deeply integrated with an engineering group. I had to build the team, you know, and establish how we would work together and so on. But then, you know, how do you work with engineers? How do you work with product managers? How do you work with QA, for example? I haven't read anywhere where UXers or designers have talked about how do you deeply collaborate with your quality assurance team so that they can pull through the concepts that you've done. And so I think there was a lot for us to learn there, learning how to build for mobile, learning how to, you know, agile was still, the practices were still being established here. So there was a lot for me to learn. And that work in agile was the origin of that book chapter I wrote in the Handbook of Business Anthropology, is learning how to do that and being able to talk to other people about how to do that, I thought was sort of an important inflection point for me. So 2 years into that, though, I started to look around and I say, wow, you know, ZS is actually a consulting company, not a software company. And that does make it hard to build software the way you would traditionally build software in a software company. And I realized, you know, the challenges that we face in B2B software are actually much harder from an engineering group. It's very hard to get access to an end user. So if your end user is a salesperson, for example, a pharmaceutical sales rep, for example, from an engineering group, I have to go talk to the person who owns the relationship with that client, and they have to go talk to someone in their sales operations group, and that sales operations group has to go talk to someone in sales management, and someone in sales management has to give us permission to talk to a rep, right? So you end up 5 or 6 steps removed from the end user, and it becomes very hard to develop good product that way. And so I became more and more enticed by the idea of trying to do something in consulting. And there was demand from the consulting team for UX services. And so I talked to the managing director and I said, hey, I think we need to do this. And they said, go for it, see what you can do. And so I started that consulting capability. We had a little team that only did UI work in India for the first year. And then in 2015, we had our first much more seasoned onshore UX people joined us. And that was really when I think things started to take off. So, I really enjoy, you may have heard this term of being an innie and an outie, right? So if you're an innie, you're working in a company and you can effectuate certain kinds of change when you're working inside a company. And when you're a consultant, you're an outie, right? You're you're helping people, but you don't own those problems for the long run. Mm. And it's two very different kinds of work and two very different kinds of hats. I really enjoy the challenge and the variety of both, but it is pretty different. I don't really know anybody else that does both. Mm. I would love to meet other people. You know, I think you might be in a consulting role and do an occasional internal project, for example, but it's very different than actually being embedded in an engineering organization. Mm. So I really love that. I feel like I really appreciate both, and I'm glad I get to do both. You know, for example, the population that we serve with the technology we produce here, it's the same user population, still life sciences, sales and marketing, more and more into clinical trials in the R&D space now. The business challenges are the same. The healthcare ecosystem challenges are the same. And one of the interesting things, which gets at to one of the questions that you've asked me, is one of the interesting things about product work is it is more longitudinal, right? So we've now got a UX team, researchers and designers that have been in place for 6 years on the product side. And they're studying the same population for the same product suite over that long period of time. And so we've talked to hundreds of users now. And that gives us a body of understanding about those users and their needs and their preferences and how they consume information and what their work life is like. And that longitudinal insight we can bring into our consulting work. So we don't always get to do the kind of research we want to do, but we can walk in with 6 years of history about sales reps, for example, and say, look, we know we can have to do some kind of abbreviated research here, but we've got the wind at our back a little bit because we've got this body of research that we can draw on so that we're not really doing design absent research.
That's a really interesting point to think about too, because you know, for a lot of our listeners, if they're coming from the academic space, just even this question of how quickly, and we mentioned with Simon Roberts' article too, how quickly research either has to be done, or if you can even sort of make the pitch that it needs to happen, right? And so, mm-hmm. UX is such an interesting space, or user experience is such an interesting sort of space because it's you know, mixes together this idea of, like, sort of as deep as one can get interaction with the users, or the people that are going to, you know, the end users of a software mm-hmm. product or a service. And then also this question of experience, right? And this is kind of this, like, the lovely anthropological term just thrown on the back of user here, where it's like, what does it feel like? Or what is it, you know, what is one's sensations? What is one's experience of interacting with something? And, you know, how that gets brought into the corporate space is really cool. So it's great to kind of hear your story thinking through this question of like how it got brought in, you know, and part of it was, you know, based on your own background and work doing this, and then this sort of ZS saying, okay, this makes sense. Like, we like this pitch. And then even to see how you have taken it your own way and sort of mixed it, as I love the term innie and outie there. And like, that's a really cool way to think about this idea of like, what is it to be both embedded and consulting? And so, cause this is a newer space, you know, that Matt and I've been talking about, we've been thinking with too, is what does it mean to be sort of inside or outside an organization? Or this is like the old school anthropological emic and edic, right? The insider and outsider perspectives.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. Right. Just a little less anthropology jargon if you talk about innie and outies, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, well, exactly. And so that's actually a good point, because I think on your blog, or maybe the DScout article that I had found when doing some research, you know, you talk about a problem that anthropology's message is not widely accessible.
Yeah.
And so what do you do in your daily role to make it more accessible?
Yeah. That's a great question. So, ultimately, the way that I tell the story is that bringing user experience to a project, whether it's a software or a service design or whatever that is, it's ultimately about bringing people, right, into the equation. And I know that's, for an anthropologist, and especially someone who might not be in tech, that just sounds so strange. Like, what do you mean you have to introduce the idea of people? But in reality, you know, you've got a business stakeholder, a business sponsor who's got some kind of pressing business problem, go to market, revenues are down, competition's fierce, right? There's these looming business problems. You've got a bunch of technologists or MBAs MBAs are more oriented to the business stakeholder. Technologists thinking about, you know, what are the available technology solutions or tools at our disposal to solve this problem? And I think it's just not surprising to me, when you think about the sort of the typical group of stakeholders that are looking at these problems, that the question of people is not at top of mind. Mm. And I think what's interesting for me and actually really exciting about the healthcare space right now is you know, there's all these tectonic plates shifting in healthcare. And I think, you know, one of the questions we get a lot from people that interview with us is, you know, what do you feel, how do you feel about working for big pharma? You know, don't you feel like you've sold out, or how do you make your peace with that? Mm. And what's really, really interesting is, I don't feel that way at all. And our clients, when you walk the halls at our clients, and so we, all the top 50 pharma companies in the world are all clients. So anytime you open your medicine cabinet and read a label, one of those is a ZS customer. Hmm. And when you walk the halls at those clients, there are pictures of patients. There are patient testimonials. There are, you know, when they have all hands or client meetings, there are patients that come to talk about how these drugs save their lives. The people that are doing this work, even if they're in the trenches dealing with some crummy pharmaceutical sales data and trying to pump it into a dashboard, they know they're walking the halls, and they know that they're doing this in the interest of people that are dying, or that whose lives are not as good as they could be without the help of pharma. And so that is, there is a really deep patient-centric orientation in these pharma companies. And yes, there are plenty of examples of people that have made bad choices. You know, you look at the price gouging and executives that have made crazy, not patient-centric decisions. But on the whole, my experience of our clients is very, very patient-centric. And so I think, and that's what's interesting, is the way that healthcare is going. You'd think, wow. So, you know, a lot of stuff in the market vilifies the pharma companies. And they're, again, not to say that they're without flaw, but when you really look at what's going on, the payers or the insurance companies are consolidating, and something like by the end of this year or middle of next year, 3 to 5 insurance company will control 80% of how people are covered in the United States.
Wow.
And so when you say, should you be afraid of pharma or should you be afraid of the payers, right? And it's not to say that pharma, because what's interesting now, and there's good and bad in all of this, and actually the doctors really lose out too, right? Because the payers or the insurance companies are telling the doctors what they can prescribe, in what order they can prescribe it, or the client doesn't get reimbursed, or the physician doesn't get reimbursed, right? So the payers are really dictating the rules of the game here. And pharma, you know, insurance and the sort of financial services space, it was quicker to make all these technology investments. And of course, as they consolidate, they have a much wider view than, say, an individual pharma company might have, right? So if they own, you know, 20-30% of the, what we call the lives or the insured lives in the United States, they have this massive view over what's happening in the market, and they can use that information to, in their contract negotiations with pharma and other players in that space. But what's really interesting about that, and what brings me back to this topic about people and patient centricity, is what's very interesting is what insurance companies are realizing is, you've probably heard the term value-based care. Mm-hmm. What they've come to realize is that what's in the best interest of the patient is often the best financial decision too. So for example, you don't want somebody readmitted to an ER, right? You don't want them to go to the ER, be treated, and be back a couple days later because the treatment wasn't effective, right? And so what happens there is, you say, it's in the best interest of that person to be treated in such a way they don't have to go back to the ER, or they have the right support services, or the right things are done so that they don't go back to the ER. It's more cost effective, but by the way, it's a heck of a lot better for that patient too, right? And so what's very interesting is this shift to value-based care actually turns out to be rather patient-centric. And same thing in clinical trials. There's this growing momentum and awareness that we can't talk about research subjects and get people to sign their lives up to take drugs that have never been tested on humans before. Like, if you don't talk about them as people and you don't treat them as patients that are going through this difficult situation, and you treat them as a, you know, a box that needs to be checked for a federal, you know, paperwork for a clinical trial, you're never going to get the patients you need to actually complete the trial. And so there's this, I think what I find to be really exciting is that all these types of experience, whether it's customer experience, patient experience, user experience, that the backdrop of the healthcare ecosystem is actually providing a great place in which to do that kind of work. Because I think there's a growing awareness that it's necessary in order for these companies to be successful in serving their constituents.
That's interesting. And so do you think that makes it easier for you to do this? Well, it sounds like it makes it easier for you to do this work, but would you also say that raises the sort of the bar of what you really need to deliver?
I just think healthcare, unlike tech and consumer, right, where you think about consumer, they're so far ahead thinking about personalization, like make your own sneakers, you know, and healthcare is just way, way far behind. So yes, it's making it easier. But, you know, if I had to think about that moment and that inflection point, the dot-com crash that I wrote about in my dissertation, healthcare is now where high tech was when I wrote my dissertation.
Interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I think, yes, they feel the urgency. They recognize that things need to change, but they're just beginning to understand these ideas about healthcare, patient centricity, you know, those kinds of things. Now, some companies are further ahead than others. But I just think I hope actually, because that we're at the beginning of something, right? Because we're talking about people now as we solve these problems.
Now, do you find that, like, I mean, that's super interesting. Do you find that, because of, for example, if tech or, you know, sort of individualized, you know, consumer products are, you know, more or less 20 years ahead of where health tech is right now, where healthcare is going and becoming patient centric, does that kind of on one level pave the way for doing sort of user centric or patient centric or, you know, this kind of research? And that seems like storytelling, patient testimonials, having photographs of patients in the hallways. Is this also kind of following on those same heels? Do you find is there a sort of pattern there?
Yeah, I think for sure. It feels like, you know, the whole thing is kind of happening again. And those of us that have experienced it in another industry are saying, oh, yeah, I mean, healthcare feels behind. But when you understand the complexity of the ecosystem, you know, the like I said, these massive things that are in play, right, when you're thinking about healthcare markets and the dynamics of government and these giant insurance providers and the, you know, the fact that it takes 17 years to get a drug to market. And so pharma companies are, you know, how do you deal with that, right? And I think there's a lot of complexity there that maybe doesn't exist in other places that can truly fail fast, you know?
But I do feel like
there's a lot of commonality there. A lot of the ways that I talked about UX 10 years ago, I'm still talking about now because it's still relevant.
Interesting. And how do you, you know, given all the complexity, do you have any tips for sort of making sense of all of that? And, you know, it would be like, say, when you studied in Bali, you know, making sense of that is incredibly complex. And certainly making sense of users can always be a little bit complex. But in, say, like maybe a consumer mobile app that has a relatively straightforward kind of one purpose, you know, it's maybe a little bit easier to wrap your arms around. So, you know, to people who are maybe coming into the industry, how do you approach that amount of sort of data with that many stakeholders?
So the thing is that little app is actually not that simple, right? So it seems like it, right? But when you think about what's happening there, so you have a pharma company that has a brand, and that brand has a certain set of go-to-market goals or competitors or things like that. And that brand team has made a decision. Usually it's the brand team that's made a decision that they want to build an app for whatever reason. But, you know, there's, I forget the number, it's like over 200,000 mobile healthcare related apps in the market today. Wow. And I think five of them own 80% of the user usage, right? Because most people that are building those apps have no idea what they're doing and how to make them usable or useful. And because the thing is in the end, unless what you're doing is providing access to web content that you could read on the web, you know, like a very basic patient information or brochure kind of stuff, like brochureware, anything else you're doing, you're probably trying to change the patient's behavior in some way, their adherence, their, you know, how they're taking their medicine, how they're tracking their treatment, what other things they're doing that might be affecting the state of their care. And, you can't just snap, build an app and without all of this other work. First of all, not just, it's, you know, for example, you want to build something for somebody who has diabetes, right? And you know that the ability to maintain sort of behavioral changes in diabetes is incredibly hard. If you're not thinking about that complexity and all of the things that have tried and failed and, you know, what kind of diabetes is it, first of all, you know, there's this whole backdrop of, like, you know, even population health and all these other things that I think if you just try to build an app in a vacuum, it's going to fail. Hmm. And in fact, that's really what's happened, actually, is the majority of things that are tried like that without that thought, the context, the backdrop, and understanding of the disease state, they fail, mm-hmm. right? Because it you can't just, you know, drop an app into this complex environment and think it's going to work.
Hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, that's a beautifully said point that, you know, because, I mean, it one of the things that reflects, you know, as you know, thinking anthropologically, it is like, right, that nothing happens in a vacuum, right? And I liked your point earlier in the conversation where software itself, of course, is a product of its own cultural environment, right? And this is, yes. you know, one of these things that I randomly read, you know, on you know, Fast Company's design blog, and they're saying that, you know, what's one of the design jobs that we think will be like in the highest demand in the next 20 years? And they speculate that it'll be data ethnographers. And this idea, like as data, as AIs, as other kind of tech in these sort of, you know, as you said too, even when you're doing longitudinal products, right, your projects, you can get more and more data. You'll have more user data that you can draw from. You can say, oh, we're actually yes. missing this piece. And so even part of that too is like having the capacity as a researcher or the necessity to look back and say, where did that data collection, how did that happen? What were the surveys asking, you know, in what context yes. were they asked? And so I think that, yeah, you're speaking to a really great point here. That's kind of cool because we're seeing it like in between the healthcare space and then like sort of the more forward, as it were, you know, air quotes, mm-hmm. Consumer based area. And so like, but in between mm-hmm. these two, we do sort of see this question of where is the data coming from, right? And how are we gathering it? And how do we sort of be responsible about that? I think that's a really great piece to think with. Because you mentioned like with this too, I want to kind of move into a question of the idea of the notion of imperfect data that you've written about before too. Mm-hmm. And that we, of course, in any kind of context, right, you never have these magical conditions where you can have the perfect amount of time, the perfect user, the perfect questions. And so, you know, so
once in a yeah. career, if you're lucky, right?
Yes. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, can you talk a bit about what you mean by like, or kind of walk us through a little bit about this idea of imperfect research? Cause I think it's a wonderful idea. That is about like grounding expectations, right?
Yep, exactly. It's I think for me, and maybe some of that also is my impatience with the idea that there needs to be just the conditions need to be just so in order to get anything done, right? Mm. Because that condition doesn't exist. It doesn't exist if you're building product, and it doesn't exist if you're in consulting, right? Mm. And so then the question is, you can say, you know, and some of it is scrappy and not all of it is beautiful, but the question is how do you make sure that you have that you're making informed decisions in whatever way possible. Hmm. You know, can you look at the usage data of an existing system that might be comparable? Can you is there other research that's been published on that same disease state that you can use as a starting point for your understanding? Mm-hmm. But to just realize that in most cases, I've never had a research proposal that we issued on the first try it was accepted. Mm. It's always, you know, cut it down, simplify it, do it faster. You don't ever get to do, you know, and even my dissertation research, if I hadn't been so desperate to finish and actually graduate, I would have kept researching forever, right? Because it's so much fun.
That makes me feel better. Okay, good.
And so I think what I like about industry in particular is it forces constraints, right? If you talk to designers or study that, you know, that actually is that makes you creative. Mm-hmm. And that's by necessity, you are forced to be more creative because you can't do the 6 months of ethnographic research that you want to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point too. Cause I'm finishing my dissertation and Matt's working on a thesis too. So we both love the idea that we're allowed to have constraints, you know, it's like you're allowed to stop. You're supposed to stop, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you can always write a book later on your own time, but get the degree done and move on.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly, right? Yeah, I wonder, speaking of that, too, I wonder if we might kind of hop over, because you're also a legend in the anthro community for starting up the anthro design Slack group and community. And that's a really interesting story. I mean, I'd love to hear, you know, to hear you tell a little bit about that and like how that got started and sort of how that's going today, because it's blown up. It's huge now.
Yeah. In 15 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. We just had our 15-year anniversary. Yeah. So anthro design. Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm proud of it. And I in retrospect, I wish I had been more aware of what a big deal it was. Now I understand it better than I did at the time. But I was exactly where you guys are now. Actually, I was writing my dissertation. I was realizing I wasn't going to stay in academia. And I realized I needed a network of people that were doing the work that I wanted to be doing. And at the time, there was a generation of anthropologists that had been at PARC or at the Institute for Research on Learning. You know, so, you know, Giddy Jordan and Lucy Suchman and Jeanette Blomberg, Melissa Sefkin, the term community of practice, which you've probably heard of, and came out of the work of Institute of Research on Learning with Etienne Wenger and John LaVey. And those were the folks, and Pat Sachs, that I went to and said, how do you do this? And there have been ebbs and flows in that in that work. There was the work at Bell Labs that Pat was very involved in, and the work on the West Coast. And I think all of those teams have seen ebbs and flows, and they've evolved. But what I realized is there was no institutional history about what had happened, and I wanted to go do that, but there was nothing except to go talk to those people. There's no way to learn about that except to go to talk to them. And so that's what I did. I started talking to them. I asked to meet with them. Funny, in the beginning, so the American Anthropology Association meetings that first year, I think, I want to say it's like 2002 timeframe, 2003, something like that, I organized a panel about anthropology and innovation in high tech. And I literally had nothing to say on the topic because I wasn't doing the work. But I chaired the panel because I could get all these great people together.
Nice. Right? Move,
and
yeah.
And I did that. So I got to meet them. I got to hear what they had to say. I did a similar thing, I want to say, at the Society for Applied Anthropology meetings in 2004, and I brought a pair, an engineer and an anthropologist, together from Intel, Microsoft, and Pitney Bowes to talk about the nature of their collaboration. And I think we just started to realize there was a lot of interest and momentum in these conversations. And, you know, there were dinners, SFAA, for example, or a dinner I hosted in New York. It was, you know, 25 plus people. And we realized, wow, this is really something. Hmm. And that was when I said, wow, and so rather than just doing this by email, let me start a listserv. I was a Unix system administrator at the time. Okay, so it was obvious to me that we needed a listserv.
That's what you do. Yeah.
That's what you do. And so, yeah, that was, I just said, okay, I'm gonna make a listserv here. And it was, you know, these 20, 25 people that I had built these connections with. And then very quickly, it was 90 people. But in the beginning, it was all anthropologists. Mm-hmm. And I think then once it got past 90, I think, we started to see, wow, there's the people we collaborate with, the engineers, the designers, and so on. And then it really started to open up. It's all been by word of mouth. I've never really advertised it because I didn't want a bunch of spammers, and I wanted the quality of the list to remain high. So it's 3,000 people globally now.
Wow, cool.
Uh-huh. We exchange somewhere between 150 and 200 messages a month. And then there's a Slack channel. So I've looked for different channels over the years. We tried LinkedIn. I tried Facebook. None of those seemed quite right for different reasons. A lot of people need to ask questions in confidence. Mm-hmm. You know, they're asking on behalf of an employer, or their customer might be on the list. And so they need to be able to post without using their work email. And so LinkedIn isn't for everyone. And Facebook, I think, felt a little too personal. Mm-hmm. So Slack is really exciting because it's a little bit like Twitter for people that use Twitter, but it's a closed community. So you have control over the conversation. And you can create discussion threads, basically. And that's taken off. I want to say it's somewhere between 400 and 600 people now. And it's pretty active. And the idea of channels is good because then people with like interests can talk to each other and get to know each other. And the meetup piece of that, I think, is particularly neat. I used to do that a lot at the beginning of Anthro Design, where I would go travel. I was traveling a lot for work. And I would go to a city and organize a dinner while I was there. And now with these meetup channels, anybody that's in an area can get to know who else is in the area and organize an event. And I like that it's sort of self-perpetuating that way, that I don't have to be the one to do that, but that it sort of has a life of its own. Hmm. It's pretty neat.
That's great. And certainly, having joined maybe 6-8 months ago, and Adam being in there now, I mean, I know that I'm finding a significant amount of helpful information in there. So I would recommend really to everybody listening to take a look at it. It's been, you know, both, from a theoretical perspective, for people looking for jobs, for the meetups, right? I mean, there's really something for anybody who's interested in this. And there's some really great people who reply very actively, you know, with excellent help when you need it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But the thing I was trying to do with Anthro Design, which, you know, I wrote about, there's a blog post I wrote about celebrating the 15 years and sort of what I was pleased about. And, you know, of course, now there's all these books about anthropology and design and anthropology. And I, I regret that I didn't write one of those books at the time, right? Because all Anthro Design precedes all of those books by a couple of years. And I wish that I had the presence of mind. I was still writing my dissertation, so I really wasn't able to go after that. But what I was trying to do at the time with Anthro Design was to really talk about the nature of collaboration and how hard it is to collaborate across disciplinary boundaries. Mm. And, you know, we talk about UX as a thing that's all lumped together. But in fact, you know, there's research and design, and there's many, many flavors of research. I have human factors engineers. I'm an anthropologist. I have people trained in HCI. And even across those boundaries, you know, we have our own challenges. But then now you start to talk about, okay, how do I collaborate with someone who's a data scientist or someone who's a deep technology expert or a deep business expert? And really what I wanted to do with Anthro Design is to talk about the nature of collaboration and how do we develop a mutual appreciation for what the other fields bring to the table so we can bring our best work forward. So for example, anthropologists are great about talking about context and about the cultural backdrop and about maybe even about some human behavior if they've studied a little psych or something. But they don't have that ability to have a laser focus on a business problem or a business outcome. And so what design does, when you think about what happens when you go to design school, is you build a portfolio by solving a series of business problems with design constraints. And so you come out with a portfolio that shows you can understand a business problem and apply a set of methods to arrive at an outcome. It's very practical in many ways, even though it's also aspirational and innovative and all of that too. And so there were just some things like that where I thought, wow, let's really talk more deeply about how we can appreciate what other disciplines bring to the table so we can do our best work. And that was really the idea. And so, but what happened, I think, is there was such desperation to talk about the work of ethnographic research and how we do that and how we do it well, that which has continued with EPIC, right? So EPIC, the EPIC conference started a year or two after Anthro Design. And was basically inspired to say there's a much bigger conversation to have. And what I love about what Ken and Tracy did in founding that was they said, look, we need to build a body of literature that we can build on. So it was similar to what I was saying, like we need to have these conversations and not have them over and over. We need to have that body of knowledge that's shared. And they said, let's write it down. And so I'm really thrilled that they did that. And I think it's been a really important part of what we do. But I still feel like we haven't gotten to that piece that to me is ultimately the challenge. Is if you look at the sort of the details and the challenges in the day-to-day work, is how do you create an environment where a developer is excited to understand human behavior and a designer is willing to invest the time and energy to understand the limitations of the technologies that we're working in.
Right? So is there a book in the future?
There is, actually, now that you mention it. There is, I've got an article that I'm working on right now for the Journal of Business Anthropology about, you know, bringing anthropology and design into the tech space and some of the challenges that we face there with the, you know, backdrop of agile and the pressure to innovate and all that kind of stuff. So that'll come out sometime early next year. And then I'm also in the middle of putting a book proposal together with Laura McNamara, who works at the National Labs. And we're going to write a book about research methods for data scientists. And so I think, you know, how do you, when you're working on these really, really sophisticated technical problems, how do you bring an understanding of users into that type of project work? So she's working at the National Labs on really complex military technology. I'm working in industry. It's not the same kind of technical complexity, but it has its own set of challenges. And what's the composition of those teams and what can we do to help those teams be thinking about the people that they serve while they're building new technology solutions?
I wonder if I think we have a few minutes left. I'm wondering if you could tell us a bit about, you know, what kind of advice would one have in terms of like, if either someone working in the software or tech space or in anthropology were trying to, you know, merge them kind of in the work you did, do you have any advice looking back and saying, you know, these are some kind of the steps I wish I had known when I was making it? I mean, you've obviously pioneered so much of the way in terms of building your own first level teams. Is there any advice looking back now that you could say, it would make sense to, you know, pay attention to X, Y, or Z, or like, don't read Don Norman's book or read Don Norman's book or whatever, you know?
You know, one of the things, if I sort of say, I don't really have any regrets because I think I've had so much fun doing what I'm doing. I don't really feel like I made any mistakes or things that I would regret. But there were moments where I was frustrated that my job wasn't UX all day, every day. And in fact, that was one of the reasons I left SAP to come to ZS, was I wanted a job where I wasn't doing UX and operations management, but that I was just doing UX. But in hindsight, when I think now about the advice that I give to grad students or people that are trying to make the transition, for example, from academia into business, the first piece of advice I give them is go get some experience in the business world. Hmm. Like, go understand how the business world works, learn to speak the language of business. You are probably familiar with the work of Leah Bewley. She wrote the UX Team of One, and she spent some time at Forrester, which is an analyst firm. And when she left Forrester, she wrote a blog post about, you know, what do we as a field need to be doing differently? And, you know, it comes into this question, things we've talked about, you know, how do you sell it? How do you, create awareness of the value? You can't do it if you can't speak the language of business.
Yeah,
because when I talk about, you know, how do you articulate the value of what we do? How do we sell what we do? I don't say, hey, it will have X usability score or X customer satisfaction score or whatever. My question, or the thing that I ask that business stakeholder, is what business outcome are you trying to drive? And then how do we use UX methods or research methods or design to help achieve that business outcome? And if you can't speak the language of business and what they're talking, you know, it sounds like the teacher on the Peanuts, right? Wah, 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 like you don't know what they're saying. You can't sell to them. You cannot make what you have to offer relevant because you don't know what's important to them. And so in a funny way, you know, I had mentioned I was just talking with a graduate student this afternoon before we got on the call together. And that was my advice to her was, you know, if you know what industry you want to work in, don't worry so much about whether it's design or not. Just go get a job and learn about the industry. Because, you know, one of the things that you're going to, especially if you're an anthropologist, my experience has been, you know, I've worked in educational institutions and financial services institutions and consulting. I've worked as an Emmy, as an Audi. I've worked in manual labor. I've done white collar work. I've worked privately held, publicly held. All of those experiences have helped me discern what kind of organization I want to work in, what kind of research I want to do or that is distasteful to me. It's also really helped me hone my observation and analysis skills on culture and the work context in the meantime, right? So I've learned about the business setting, but I've also learned a lot about culture across different kinds of work environments, and I've also learned a lot about myself and along the way as well.
Cool.
Yeah, fantastic.
I don't know if we have, we can do kind of a, we do sometimes like a bonus question at the end, and what we can put, put this out for our special listeners. So Matt, I don't know if you have a burning question that you have left that we want to ask. And it could either be, I'm looking at our notes. I mean, one of them could be these questions of the kinds of theory things that have come into it. I don't know if we need to ask that or not, but Matt, is there a question that you've been waiting to ask that we could do or?
No, I mean, I think we've covered most things on our list.
Awesome.
I think the one, guys, if I had to say the one thing that we had talked about is that you had this question about the nature of longitudinal, how do you deal with the fact that you can't do longitudinal research?
Yeah, great.
And so I have two examples of how I've tackled that I think would be worth talking about, because I think, again, there's this idea, there's this despair, oh, if I'm in consulting, I'm never going to get to do, I have to be in R&D to do that kind of longitudinal research. And I don't want people to think that's the case. And so I have these two examples that I'd love to share if you're
awesome.
Open to that.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Bonus question. Here we go. So so the two examples I want to share is that I had one client that I was working with in one of the sales arms at SAP. And they had come to me, and I had referenced this briefly earlier. They had just needed a website designed. And I was responsible for the intranet and all website publishing at the time. So yeah, we can build your website. And I thought, well, maybe you want to know about the customer satisfaction of that website, or maybe we want to see if that site is usable or if it has the right content on it. And over time, I built a lot of trust and rapport with this client. And I really mean over years, two or three more years. And eventually what came to pass is they invited us to come and actually observe their users in their work context, and to make some recommendations. And we did an ethnographic study there, and we came back with all kinds of insights. And it really led to some, you know, some eye-opening thinking for them about the nature of the work that they were doing and that they should be doing. And the following year, when they started to do strategic planning, they asked us to come. They said, you know more about our organization now than we do. Will you come and be part of the strategic planning with us?
Right?
So, you know, it's not a one time, you know, you don't sell one project and ta-da, you've done it. It's by building this trust and this rapport over time. Similarly, here at ZS, you know, I had mentioned, we work with similar types of users, whether we're working on product or we're working on custom solutions for clients. And I've had the same sponsor over a multi-year period, and we've done research, both sponsored research, internally paid for research, and research with clients, and we've built up a body of knowledge about a certain user type. And we have, every year that we've gotten new research, we've come up with new design ideas. Like, we could make their lives better like this. We could make their lives better like this. And this year was the third iteration of that. So over a three-year period, we now have talked to hundreds of these types of users. And we just had this moment where we're like, oh my gosh, this is it. There's a confluence of new tech, shifting landscape, new clients. This design idea just was just something. We just nailed it, right? But it was the third time around. We're 3 years in. And it's been a bunch of small investments. It wasn't one gigantic project. But the same sponsor that trusts and experience-led, you know, technology innovation and some real commitment to see these ideas through. And our persistence, and by the way, collecting all that research and aggregating it and telling a story about these body of users, that's a single story now, not treating each one as a separate research project, but treating them as a body of work. And that's allowed us to do something really innovative that I'm hoping is going to ship next year.
Very cool.
Yeah. And I have one quick follow-up. So, you know, let's say you, even if it's not ethnographic research, let's just say it's a sort of a quick and dirty method. You come up with some insight. Do you have any, maybe guidance for listeners who might be in this space and they do some research and they provide some insights back and then the customer doesn't do anything with them? And now the researcher is frustrated, and which happens, this is business. They're not always going to take our suggestions. Right. So have you dealt with that, and do you have any sort of thoughts on how?
For sure. Yeah, I think that happened. And in now, you know, as my role has gotten more senior now, the way that I would actually characterize that is a relationship problem, right? Either you've delivered the wrong thing because you didn't understand that client, or you didn't understand their client needs, or you've packaged it in a way that they can't do anything about. And that to me just means you don't understand your customer well enough. Your buyer. You don't understand the person that bought the research from you. Or you don't understand enough about the challenges that they're facing, right? So they may be looking at downsizing, they may have a new boss, they may have had budget cuts, they may have, pressure to do something differently. They may have been trying to innovate and sort of panicked that they're not really able to pull the ideas through. But to me, what that usually looks like to me is you don't have a good enough relationship with the person you did the research with to be able to ask those questions. What did I do wrong? Did we answer the wrong questions? Was it not actionable? Maybe they needed to have been part of the research synthesis and write-up so that you could have made those insights more relevant for them. But there could be all these other things going on, you know, in their work life, in their work context. And I think if you have a really good relationship with a client, hopefully you can ask that. And in fact, if you're an innie, you have to ask that because it's going to be your same client over and over again. You have to get through that. But if you're in consulting, it's really easy to kind of slink away and say, ouch, that didn't go anywhere. Let me move on. But the brave thing to do would be to say, wow, you know, we did all this work. We hope it met your needs. We found that you're not doing anything with it. Can you help us understand why? Is there something we can help you do to bring these research insights to life? Or, just try to take some ownership and help them actually solve that problem. And you'll learn a lot about them and hopefully build a more trusting relationship where you can find those things out before you hand in your final deliverable in the future.
Yeah, perfect. Seek to understand all the stakeholders, not just the end user.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. Yep, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's the big thing that's happening in enterprise UX, right? So you talk about enterprise UX and how is it different than what's happening elsewhere. I think what I see in the Rosenfeld Media has the Enterprise UX Summit. They have the Design Ops Summit. And really what's happening is it's people that are trained in design learning about how large matrix business organizations operate and figuring out how to bring design into those contexts. Mm. And that's an example of that. Like it's not a little boutique design firm. If you're a really terrific ethnographic consulting company like Red Associates, people just come to you, right? Mm-hmm. In the early days of eLab and a Conifer, right? People go to those IDEO. They go there because they want something very specific, mm-hmm. right? Not everybody works in that kind of company, right? And so that's the, you know, the challenge is to figure out how to, you know, you're learning and teaching with your clients and your stakeholders as you go. And that's, and in a business setting, in a big enterprise setting, there's a lot more stakeholders and a lot more complexity in terms of how decisions get made. And so to me, it's the work. It's almost like, you know, getting an MBA, you have to learn how that business context operates so that you can do your best work in that context.
Very well said. Well, Natalie, thank you so much. This has been an enlightening and amazing conversation. Where can the good people, the listeners, find you? I mean, in terms of either on Anthro Design Slack group or the listserv?
Yeah. Well, so Natalie Hanson, H-A-N-S-O-N .com is my website, and that has my blog and links to my writing and so on. And then for Anthro Design, it's exactly that. It's anthrodesign.com. There's a Join Us link. And from there, you can find out about how to join the list or the Slack or find out some more about some of these other related organizations like Ethnography Matters and EPIC.
Hmm. Very cool. Perfect. Yeah, so we can say, you know, Matt and I can attest that Anthro Design has been, it's been a great Slack group. You know, we said we've been on there for a couple of months now, and it's been a wonderful resource. We've met a number of people, like both in person and online, and found ideas about jobs and how to talk about different, you know, case studies, different projects. And so, yeah, really, again, we want to encourage all listeners, if you're interested in anything to do with anthropology and business and design, absolutely check it out, because it's an amazing community that, you know, we don't have to be lonely anymore, right? We're all out there together.
Sounds good. Right,
thanks, Dan.
Thank you. My pleasure.
All right, listeners, thanks for joining us. You've been hearing our conversation with Natalie Hanson. We've been talking about UX, about tech, about learning how to work with different kinds of customers and questions of trust in conversation. So we'd love you to tweet at us, you know, what has been some of your biggest takeaways from the episode? What were the, any ideas that Natalie shared that we conversed about? So if you can, you know, drop us a tweet at This Anthro Life, and we'd love to hear what, you know, what ideas struck you. And so we can kind of bring you more and more content that, that speaks to you and is relevant. And so, you know, we hope you enjoyed. And as always, this has been Adam Gamwell.
And I'm Matt Arts.
Yeah, so thanks for joining. We'll see you next time on This Anthro Life.